this is the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission for October 8th, 2012, and I would like to begin by asking the Bureau of Development Services staff to introduce themselves. The members of the commission here today are...
Kirk Renzetta.
Harris Matarazzo.
Carrie Richter.
Brian Emmerich.
Jessica Ingeman.
Oh, I forgot to have Bureau of Development Services introduce themselves.
Tim Herron.
Commission members are private citizens appointed by the mayor to provide review of requests for landmark designation and coordinate other historic preservation programs. We are not paid but serve entirely as volunteers. More detailed information regarding the purpose and function of the commission can be found in the Portland Zoning Code. Commission members must declare a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact prior to the staff presentation of a particular case. If a commission member has a conflict of interest or bias, they are not allowed to participate in commission discussion or voting on that project. If a commission member hasn't had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record, and it is subject to rebuttal. We've got a couple of things on the agenda today, and we are going to start with the Historic Resources Code Improvement Project. We got some materials, and I believe we have to get our comments in to Jay and Tim today because the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability Commission, Planning and Sustainability Commission, is taking this matter up at their hearing tomorrow night. So, not true. Jay.
So, both of these are just briefings, just to let you know where we are in the process. There'll be a formal hearing in November, which I'll cover. So there, you have till October 17th, actually, if you want to give us comments to incorporate into a discussion draft.
And just to add on that, the timing is important because we will be briefing, or Jay will be, I won't be able to attend tomorrow, the Plan Sustainability Commission. So in terms of order, having your at least initial thoughts, perspectives, can be carried over when presumably the obvious question from the Plan Sustainability Commission may be, well, what did Landmark say? Though they don't necessarily need to be formal or a consensus.
Thank you for clarifying. Take it away.
Great. So does everyone have a copy? Because I don't have a presentation. I'm just going to go through this. Everyone has it?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Anyone in the audience want a copy?
No?
All right. Lee, he's going to take it. So what I was hoping to do is just briefly go over this. Shouldn't take more than me talking, hopefully, more than 5 to 10 minutes. Please interrupt me anytime you want. My intent was to share what we've heard from the community in terms of their reaction to the issues and options paper. Honestly, we haven't gotten a whole lot of feedback yet, but we have quite a bit scheduled. So we should be getting that soon. And what we're, as Tim mentioned, get you guys to weigh in on what the alternatives are. So this is the beginning of a community conversation. We're in the very early stages. I just really want to emphasize that. And on page 2 of the report, it has the project schedule. And we did a briefing with the scope. That was back in, I believe, late June, early July. With the commission, we also went to Planning Sustainability Commission. We also met with the Development Review Advisory Committee Subcommittee, and that was just on the scope, what it is we were going to hopefully do as part of this project. Over the summer, we did quite a bit of research that I'll talk about, and we developed this issues and options paper. And what we're trying to do is just start that conversation, get the options out there, give people something to react to. And we are meeting with, tomorrow, as Tim said, with the Planning Sustainability Commission. Irvington again for a second time actually on Wednesday. We'll go to the Remodelers Thursday morning and the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources Thursday evening. And then we have also gone to the Northeast and Southeast coalitions, neighborhood association coalitions. And we also did a press release. When we released this, we sent it out to almost 700 people in all the media outlets to try to get attention to what it is we're doing. So the schedule forward, we want to take all this, what we hear about the issues and options paper, and create a discussion draft, and that's where we actually write the code. But we really wanted to start with the issues and options, because it's easier to have a conversation, we're hoping, about the concepts
as opposed to, you know, how you write that particular sentence in the code, because that's going to get that's going to be a whole different conversation. But sort of get direction on where what it is we want to accomplish with this project. We'll take that feedback and we'll come back to you in, I believe, the first week of December is what we're shooting for, and we'll have a discussion draft. And the draft is that, it's a discussion. We'll take public testimony, or you will take public testimony. We'll hear feedback, we'll incorporate changes, and then staff will write a proposed draft. And that will go to the Planning and Sustainability Commission in January. They'll hold a hearing, and then they will make a formal recommendation to City Council. And then City Council will hold a hearing again. So standard legislative process. So any questions about the process? It's quick, 8 months. So just very quickly, just to let you know what we did in terms of the background. I think you've seen this in the project goals, what we will do. But really the overall purpose is to sort of reassess when historic design review is necessary and appropriate. And there's a lot of different ways that we're going to do that, and I'll talk about those in more detail. But to inform the discussion, we did do some research, permit data. Tim actually did a great job pulling together permit data from the last 18 months, and that told us a number of things about what we've been experiencing in terms of what the potential problems are, and also identify, most importantly, that over half of those cases could benefit from some sort of code amendments, code improvements. We also did a survey of other cities. That's on page 3. And Liza Mickle did a great job. She looked at 9 other cities and sort of what did they do with these specific problems that we were tasked with addressing. And that told us quite a bit in terms of, you know, visibility is a consideration that most cities use these days. But a number of other things as well. So page 4, these are the discussion issues. Again, it's laying out the broad range of options, not necessarily saying what is appropriate, but it's to get that conversation going. But number 1 under A is accessory structures. And sort of in true Portland fashion, we are adding regulatory complexity as opposed to removing it. So we're trying to, we realize that accessory structures, particularly garages, have not been going through historic design review. They've been demolished if they're under the 300 square foot threshold. So we're proposing, well, maybe we should revisit that. So what we do is we, for each one, we lay out a background, what the options are, and any sort of notes taken into consideration. Page 5 is the next 2, interior light walls and fire escape removal. Those are not residential. The focus of the project is really on homeowners. But these are sort of small code cleanup things that we think we could accomplish as part of this project. So exempting interior light wells on commercial buildings as well as fire escapes if the fire marshals deems it dangerous. Number 4 gets a little more contentious. Wheelchair ramps or accessibility structures, having been more clarity in the code in terms of whether or not they should be exempt. And then storm windows. Again, providing clarity in the code. Are they exempt? Under what circumstances? Does it make sense? You know, something that's not permanently attached, the next homeowner could take it off potentially. Should that be exempt as well? So there's some examples. The next page, page 6, feel free to interrupt me if you want to have questions about something. Number page 6, the B is where it gets interesting in terms of the general review procedures. So we're trying to look at, is there a quicker review, which helps in terms of lowering the total fees, and also helps in terms of the amount of time it takes to get a response from Bureau of Development Services for a specific project. So we laid out the different current procedure types, and we talked about, well, what are some options? One is what we're calling sort of an administrative process, one where it's pretty much, you know, you look at it and say, yeah, that makes sense, but it has some sort of eyes on it and allows us to sort of give them a quick response to say, yes, you're okay going forward with that. The second one is sort of, again, a traditional land use process, but it's goes back to sort of the original type one, which is a shorter time frame. And the idea is, can we create shorter review processes for certain types of things, minor things, that makes sense, or we could do both. And then the fun gets, the fun we have is figuring out, okay, well, how do we apply these new review procedures? And that's the next page. Window repair and replacement, that's always a fun topic. And there are different ways, of course, we try to pepper in sort of experiences from other cities, how they handle it. But for each of these, what we try to talk about is, okay, what are the options? So for window replacement, we could say certain types of replacement are exempt. So if it's a basement window, sure, it's exempt. Or for the same example, number two, you could go through an administrative process. You say, I want to replace this window, basement window. They go to counter Bureau of Development Services. They say, okay, that sounds good. You get a letter written by the director, and that's their administrative decision. The next option is you could write some standards that say if you meet X, Y, and Z, then it's allowed, but it's still a land use process. Or you could do that new procedure for, let's say, the new type one, which is a 21-day comment period. So again, just showing the full range of options. Next example, number two, restorations. That is another one that's, one of the things that was surprising for us was the relatively few number of true restorations that are happening. But again, is there a way that we can kind of incent that to happen? And we don't want to necessarily, although true restoration is incredibly expensive, there's a lot of documentation involved in it, is there a way to basically lessen the cost or the time required to go through that process to encourage true restoration? The next one, number three, minor alterations. This is a tricky one. We don't define what a minor alteration is. You could do it a number of ways. You could say, if it's, say, an addition to a house that's less than, I don't know, 500 square feet or 300 or 200, pick a number. Or if it's less than a certain percentage of the total square footage of a house. You could say, all right, well, if that is what we call a minor review, then you have the options again. You could exempt them, you could go through the administrative procedure, you could do the standards, or you could do the shorter review, type one review. You guys aren't stopping me, so I'm just going to keep going. Pretty much done. And then finally, it's related, the visibility from the right-of-way. That's definitely something we've heard the most about and concern about. So we felt it was important to have its own section, but it's related. It's sort of the same thing. If it's not visible or less visible from the right-of-way, is there some sort of lesser review that we could encourage people to, say, have those window replacements be at the back or in addition to a home, be on the back of the home, where it has the least amount of impact on a historic resource. And there are lots of different ways that you can do that, and there are lots of examples out there of how to do that. And then the last section, terminology, just changing some of the chapter titles. It's more of internal stuff, try to be consistent. And then definitions is sort of the last big one. And the definitions will sort of follow where we come out of the decisions on all the previous material. So that's all I have. Just want to make sure that you are aware of what we are doing, or what stage we are in the process. And if you have thoughts or ideas of things that we should be looking at or concerns about what we've laid out, definitely like to hear that.
Thanks, Jay. How do you all want to start?
Tell me what you don't like.
Well, I'll start. I have real concerns about these new procedures. You have one that is no local appeal, strictly administrative decision, and then you have one that's a 21-day comment period, but no local appeal. In my experience with doing land use law, it is extraordinarily difficult to write clear and objective standards when you're not going to provide a local appeal. I mean, that's really, if you're going to take either of these two, I think that's where you end up. And so I'm envisioning in my mind things like the window reveal is X number of inches, or the, you know, it's a wood window of this quality, or it, I mean, it would have to be a check the box kind of determination. And you say here, this process would be similar to documentation for a nonconforming use. I've litigated nonconforming uses because they're not clear and objective, because it takes discretion to determine whether or not a nonconforming use has been continuous and what its intensity is and all of those things. So things, it's very hard for me to envision in my mind how you're going to draft clear and objective criteria that are going to have the effect of cutting out a big swath of these and making them more efficient. And I think it would be helpful in just for me to understand this if somebody did this in an example in with windows or with additions. Right. And I mean, I don't, just so I could visualize, you know, here are what we think are going to be the pool of windows that fall into this administrative process. Or here are the pool of windows that we're going to review, and here are the pool of windows that are going to come before staff in a more formal process. And because it's hard for me to apply this in the abstract.
Yeah, that's definitely the next step. You know, we realize we need to have those visuals. We need to be able to explain these based on, you know, specific examples. I guess what we're trying to do is get feedback more at a higher level. Of okay, well, that window replacement. So are windows so important that we don't even want to consider exempting them, even in the rear of the house? I mean, so that's sort of what we're trying to get at, as opposed to, okay, well, this is the review procedure, and this is, you know, this is how it's written, this is how it works. And yes, there are some challenges to these procedures, and we do need to flesh them out more, I agree.
And I'm not even sure, under B, if you can have the 21-day comment period and no local appeal if you got some discretionary scrutiny. I'm not even sure if you can do that under 215-175.
And those are the kinds of things we need to dial in, Gary, and that's why you're so important on this commission.
Yeah. Sure. A little free legal advice for you.
If I might, Gary, yeah. Just to put where these came from, was really kind of some competing demands. One demand is to make preservation accessible and affordable. The other demand being the bureau that implements it is a fee-based bureau based on applications that come in the door. So the rationale, while it may be legally flawed, though sometimes that happens, was to, one, kind of slightly pervert an existing type one land use process and make it shorter, meaning faster for an applicant, which in some minds incentivizes getting the right work done. The other, relative to, and I coined the phrase, this administrative process, we currently do zoning confirmations, right? We write a zoning confirmation letter and conforms what you can do, what you can't do on the property. It is possible, I think, to have some clear and objective checkboxes that within the submittal of an application, we can effectively have potentially, and please don't quote me, a $250 historic confirmation letter. It's very similar to what San Francisco does, which is a certificate of appropriateness, where, to your point, arguably some discretion is applied, but effectively is a lower fee, a faster process for some of those. You want staff to touch it, but you also want it to be fast and quick to the process, like window replacements or minor changes, minor alterations. And so that's where the competing goal. We're trying to put multiple options on the table. Hopefully one of them works, maybe all of them work, but effectively it's faster, lesser fees, and ultimately if we could establish a groundwork of getting these done, it could potentially ripple into the next fee schedule, reducing all fees potentially. So, a little background.
In the absence of appeals, is the thought that would just, is it cost related?
Well, yes. But with no local appeal, anything can still be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. So, correct. I mean, we're feeling like, as staff, we do a pretty good job of handling what needs to be done on the minor alterations level. You do not need to see every window replacement appeal. We know what we need to do, yeah. And we get there. So that was the intent.
I'm wondering, I've done a fair amount of appellate work in my life, if having an appeal, but having a cost associated with that appeal, in other words, so that proponent would have to be confident enough about their case that they would be willing to, you know, do it, and that the cost of that would pay for staff time to oversee it. I mean, I just, at the top of my head, I don't know if that would make sense or if that's been thought of.
Well, we currently do not require a fee for neighborhood associations to appeal, so that would be a significant change in city policy.
Other thoughts about this or anything else?
Do we need to go through?
Yeah, I think
the document
we should.
And maybe
I think we should
through each sure. item, starting with the accessory structures.
Yep.
You can also mark it up and send it to us if you like as well.
Let's start with the accessory structures, Jessica. What do you think?
Okay, so just to make sure I'm clear, so garages, if they're under a certain square footage, they can either be demolished or you could build a new garage as long as it was under that limit. And you also said that like masonry walls are another accessory structure, so is that like a retaining wall? Are there any other examples of
fences?
Fences are accessory structures, like sheds, mm-hmm. things like that.
It can quickly get into the weeds,
okay.
But however, and particularly in the Irvington Historic District, as I've mentioned before, we're hearing the question asked 2,813 different ways, and so it's revealing some issues where we do want to protect views, view sheds, front yards, fences, retaining walls kind of fall into that category. We currently, the code language is less clear, mm-hmm. so here's an opportunity to clarify it. Ironically, maybe make it more strict than it is right now, but for the right reasons.
Right.
And then the garage is probably the more focused challenge right now.
But to be clear, we're not proposing anything other than a structure as it's defined by the code currently. So we're not proposing fences or retaining walls. Or.
Okay, right, you're just proposing structures.
Right. Well, and that's where we're going to have some clarity in the code, and that's where we're getting into definitions, because it's not as clear as it could be.
Mm-hmm. So are there currently any incentives for folks to keep their accessory structures the way they are just because of the property line issues and setback?
I'm sorry, Kirk, could you say that
Is
again?
Is there kind of a built-in incentive for folks to keep their accessory structures where they are and how they are, just in terms of issues of setback that they may have to go through if they demolish it and want to build something else?
Not unless it was already non-conforming or legal non-conforming.
I mean, there's definitely some of those, so mm-hmm. They're built on a property line and it's not a firewall or whatever.
It's definitely a
Yeah, there's some definitely non-conforming stuff.
So do we think that garages, both demo and new construction, should not be exempted and that they should go through historic design review?
My vote is C.
Yeah, I would agree with that, too.
Okay. Their comment. So for the
and would an accessory dwelling unit already would be reviewable now? I'm assuming, right, an ADU.
Yeah, that the term garage is used very specifically because it's generally it's not a living area. And once you bring accessory dwelling units into it, building code comes in, life safety,
yeah.
setbacks, firewalls.
Okay.
light wells seem to me like they could be exempted.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I had similar feelings on the fire escape removal.
Yep.
Agreed.
As far as the wheelchair ramps go, is there a definition for temporary versus permanent?
Oh, they get a right one.
That's a great question, Commissioner.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
That's a term we also don't define in our code. Generally speaking, however, if it needs a building permit, we consider it permanent. Mm-hmm. There are different types of ramp structures that do not trigger building permits. They're kind of self-contained aluminum kits.
Right.
And by virtue of that, they're not considered permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So a reasonable person that doesn't read the code every day might consider that temporary.
So I think one of the big challenges with this is that the temporary ones, while it's great that they can be easily removed and they don't harm the structure, they usually look the absolute worst and they do the most visual damage to a historic district. So tough one. But it also is, I think, as pointed out here, an equity issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems it's an equity issue and there's not that many people
requiring
or that. And if it's easily removable, it seems a fair thing to me.
I agree.
I think you're going to have to define what temporary is, obviously, and that it's not damaging the structure or easily removed.
Okay.
Agreed.
Storm windows, I thought that exempting them if they have little or no impact on the
But this is one of those examples of all kinds of discretion in little or no impact.
Right.
I mean, when do they have little or no impact? I mean, how long is the list going to be of examples of storm windows that we've decided have little or no impact? And is it going to be fact determinative depending on which district you're in?
And I would also say, like the extruded variety that's mentioned in here, they may not damage the windows. In fact, they protect them, but I've had neighbors in historic homes that have had those on their windows for like decades and they look terrible, so
I have them on my windows. They do look terrible.
I mean, maybe to be exempt, it should be a wood storm window or something more specific.
I didn't put them on my windows, by the way. I'm not taking them down yet.
I believe you on that. The silver lining is your windows will be brand new underneath, though.
Do you want to move on to window repair and replacement?
Yep.
So we're skipping the alternative procedures.
Oh, well, do you have other comments about that?
Well, just that I guess we're saying, if I'm understanding this correctly, so some things might be completely exempt. And then other things may be more of an expedited review process is what the intent of the type one is. And my experience right now is just as an architect, having done both type ones and lots of type twos, is that there's very little difference in those two right now. So unless you can make more of a distinction about those two and abbreviate the time frames and the process, I don't think there's a lot of value in having two different types of procedures. So, but I also hear what you're saying about the no appeal and the time frame and that kind of thing. So. That's all.
All right, window repair and replacement. I didn't, just a question on other jurisdictions. Denver uses a minor review only when 1 to 3 windows that are not on a primary facade or do not have significant character are being replaced. So you can alter between 1 and 3, you can replace between 1 and 3 windows if it's on the back of the house?
Yeah, I think that's essentially it. But they've defined all of that. What's a primary facade? What's a secondary facade?
Sure.
Yeah.
And then New Orleans is a two-tiered system of review. Depends on visibility and preservation. And Charlotte exempts rear and side elevations. And our practice largely right now, in the most general terms, has been to prefer repair except for when there's an assertion that it can't be repaired, mm-hmm. in which case it's replacement. And we haven't set, in my mind, a sort of numeric threshold under which you go too far and you replace them all. Is that a correct summation of kind of our general practice right now?
I would say that's correct with one addendum. We have not so much had that conversation as often on single-family dwellings as we have had on multi-story commercial buildings, mm-hmm. where there's a significant dollar threshold and we've asked for a window study. Clearly in the category of almost 2,813 ways to ask the question, there's a lot of different examples of much smaller scale residential structures where that is a challenge, where it's addition or a couple windows here and there. It kind of gets into the minutia of, it triggers this full review that would cover a whole house or just two or three windows. And that really kind of gets at the heart of, we're trying to narrow the scopes or provide quicker reviews for small scopes.
And I've just had too, on the commercial examples, we've kind of defaulted to the National Trust standards for, you know, the mm-hmm. threshold. They have a percentage, you know, that you've got to hit when they do the study. But I think when we've talked about, we've discussed this issue a couple times on appeal cases, I believe, one with the Lads Edition, I recall, where we encourage the use of storm windows for energy efficiency that are removable versus tearing out historic fabric and replacing. So I think we've kind of talked that way, at least in terms of policy.
Go ahead.
There's a way to incentivize repair over replacement. It seems like most of the text here deals with replacement as opposed to repair. And if we could develop a set of circumstances that would allow, you know, folks to get through the process faster if they did certain things on the repair end as opposed to replace.
And that, curiously enough, is already in place. I mean, we've demonstrated that a lot. And one ironic twist, I think, in this and having quicker, faster, maybe cheaper review processes, it may actually open the window, so to speak, to people choosing a review process that they may hear no, meaning those windows actually can be repaired and maintained in kind, and that's exempt from review. And while we do have some language like repair and maintenance is exempt, we don't define those terms yet. We use common dictionary meaning, but nevertheless, we get to have it in our code. But then we also have a conversation over email or phone calls, usually multiple times, documentation, so on and so forth, on the city's dime, not an applicant's dime, to show that it is indeed a repair and that it is exempt. So that's in place. We hope to tighten that up. And that has actually worked on several occasions because people do not want to go through an 8-week process of documenting and getting new windows, but that not all the time.
So how do we feel about exempting window replacement on like rear elevations, just sort of as a blanket, you know, either?
I'm reluctant to do that. And as much as I would like to make this more efficient and I would like to make this cheaper and I just can't envision a way that we would say that.
It just seems to me it's a context-based decision. Every situation seems to be a little different. Just thinking about the range of residential property types in Irvington alone, encounter one of any number of different circumstances where that could be some harm to historic fabric. Sorry. I was just kind of saying that the decision is kind of context-based. In other words, the diversity of residential housing and domestic architecture in Irvington is very diverse, and there are some circumstances where you could conceive of replacing windows on a rear elevation that may not be that visible but could harm the characteristics that make that resource important.
Mm-hmm. What about the basement elevation windows? We've been more flexible with basement windows because of the moisture and...
We've allowed fiberglass down there or even vinyl, I think. Yep.
Would you all be okay with that in the basement on the non-primary or the non-street-facing elevations?
Non-street-facing.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Okay, we're cut now. We've probably eliminated 0.006 of the...
Do we complicate things if we say that we would allow window replacement on a rear elevation as long as it's, X type of window? Does that just make it more complicated when you have this list of...
You mean like a wood window of this?
Basically, if you're replacing... right. So you have a single pane wood window, and if these people are dead set on they want the energy efficiency and they don't want to do storms, if on the rear elevation they're putting in an insulated similar 1/1 to match what was there window unit, is that okay, or are we still feeling?
I couldn't because it's not in my experience, but could you, Brian, identify what those characteristics of that would replacement window would be?
Yeah, but I think there's different levels when you get into the wood replacement window. I mean, I think, the highest level is building essentially an exact replica, which can be done. It's a full custom sash. They're going to have to do a knife detail and stuff to match the profiles. You're still going to be a little different because the glass is much heavier, so it kind of depends. It's not such a big deal on a double hung, but on a casement when you've got a swinging weight, uh-huh. that can be an issue. So, but, if someone's going to that level, it is pretty hard to tell,
what's the next tier
so
down?
A next tier down would be just a wood, kind of mid-custom window, like a Posey or a Pella or, any Marvin, something like that, that's a semi-custom, but they use their standard profiles. They already have fixed rail and style dimensions. There are some choices you can make, but it's not going to be an exact replica of what was there. But visually, it's fairly good, from a distance. And then the next tier down from that would be going to, a clad-type product, on the outside and wood on the inside, which... Again, it's going to look similar, but they're simulated divided lights when you're going to do the divided lights versus the true divided light window. So for a real aficionado, there are differences that you're going to see. So it just kind of comes back to the integrity and how tight you want to keep that, I guess.
I might be able to live with the second tier on the non-primary.
Like the side and rear facade.
Side and rear.
Okay. Well, maybe we should think about this and mm-hmm. we write up our comments. We can.
Yeah.
Portland having a lot of hills, there are homes where the primary facade, for example, is on the street, but built into the side of a hill, a basement window can be seen, can maybe have a view, for example, and can be seen. Obviously, it's a view window, but people can also look from the other side and look in, and it could be, although not a primary. Not the primary facade, it's a rear facade, one that is also easily seen.
Well, we could limit that. We could say not visible from a public right-of-way.
Well, one point you make, Harris, that I think is a good one, actually, because I wasn't thinking that way, is that I'm thinking Irvington, but actually this applies to all historic districts.
Yes.
Kings Hill, other ones as well. So we do need to think about the broader spectrum on that. There are some windows, it's really like a leaded glass window, for instance. It's really, really hard to make a thermal pane, a leaded glass window that looks anything like a believable replica right. of what was there.
Tim.
Thank you. I just point of clarification. If the we use Brian's tiers, the middle tier, of course, would include it the highest level as well, meaning a wood for wood. I would just clarify, make sure I'm hearing correctly. a side elevation can also face a street, so like a corner lot. So I want to be clear if we're talking about interior lots or we're talking about street facing frontages. So just a point of clarification is side and rear, generally speaking, I understand, and that would apply to majority of infill lots. I don't know if we want to apply that side that faces a corner lot, which has full street frontage, would still fall under that exemption.
So we'd call it, define it as street facing, essentially.
Non-street facing elevations, maybe.
Yep.
Or ones that aren't viewable from a right of way would even be broader.
I think you have to be careful with that, though, because, like, how, what level do you take that?
No,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I can see it from this one little sight line from 100 yards away, you know.
Well.
And we could come back. That's getting into the weeds, but I could definitely, yeah, the difference when it's winter and all the leaves are down and how much you see versus the summer, you know.
Well, and if we're talking about the second tier, I mean, that's still some pretty good windows.
Yeah, it's still a good level, and I think that, you know, the integrity and the authenticity is proportional to the distance of the viewer, you know.
Yeah.
So if it's on the side of the house and you're a ways away, it's going to look much more believable than when you get right up to it, you know. And that's so.
And so then what we would be looking at then maybe would be you get outright repair and then you get some kind of administrative process limited review. Maybe like a complete administrative or this administrative 21-day comment if you do a second tier window.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the incentive for the repair. Other comments on that?
I'll say that I get a little concerned when we talk about saying that it's only the front elevation they can have the windows replaced, because my house is in Irvington, and when you're walking up to my house, you get an oblique view, and the windows actually that have a lot of character are the on the side, but they're, you know, close to the front of the house. So it's just one of those things where actually the two windows that are on the front of my house don't have that much character. It's the ones that are on the sides that do. So it's a tricky thing if we're going to say that sides become.
Well, what if you had some sort of, I'm trying to understand how you would legalize it. That's your guys' job, Gary and Harris. Some sort of a definition of a character defining window, though.
Yeah.
And in my mind, where I go is I think about multiple lights, you know, something that's got a lot of divided lights, which would include leaded glass or some of the art glass or any of these lots of divided lights in the transom, you know, the arch windows with the spider webs, you know.
Yep.
Anything like that has got to be replaced, single glazed, like for like, if it's totally shot or repaired.
You know, a lot of people who have decorative windows, the dining room on the side elevation, and it's over a buffet in the dining room. So, you know.
Yeah, the piano window. There's.
And there are multiple lights, or it's leaded, or it, you know, obviously if it's got stained glass, a lot of times people aren't trying to get.
That's really where the replacement windows don't do a good job. And even in multi-light wood windows, I mean, you start seeing they're simulated divided lights, you know, it's just not the same. So.
Okay.
Ready to move on to restorations?
Yep.
Any thoughts on that?
I don't know why we would prohibit it.
No.
Make it easy.
Yep.
I would say we just need some standards for restorations.
Yeah, can we just pick national interior standards? I mean, Secretary.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here. So, for instance, I'd be interested in your mind what the scope of a restoration is. What types of projects, maybe the simplest to the most complex?
Bringing back a porch that's been altered.
Mm-hmm. Adding back some historic detail that was clearly like photograph evidence or some sort of.
See some bungalows in Irvington that they've had the kind of mid-century wrought iron in place of the historic columns that we put in. So if you want to put back original sort of porch columns.
My neighbor ripped out his 1910 leaded glass windows in the shed dormer and put in a sliding vinyl with plywood for the trim. I think that would be eligible.
Okay. So we've had is maybe in a larger scale proposals where we've seen entire porches that were removed or stripped down. They want to return them. So I'm hearing in the world of encouraging preservation and restoration, the commission would like to see that as an exempt review. The challenge from PDS standpoint is that obviously is not something that can be easily documented, and certainly would want the oversight of staff to ensure that it truly is a restoration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it in itself, in today's world, would be a review. And if with all the dots and crossed T's, it would be a rubber stamped review process. So that my only heads up would be quantifying the cost and figuring out how we would budget for that kind of a review.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's the challenge. If it's not going to be reviewed, how do you determine whether they authenticated it and are doing it properly, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think it needs staff eyes on it.
Cool. Thank you.
Minor alterations.
First, we need to define minor. I think that's...
As I was wondering before, the one we just had, whether does that, do people talk about that in terms of percentages? I mean, percentage of the work being done or percentage of the structure being affected? I don't know if that's a mathematical term or it's.
I wouldn't want to do it in a quantitative way like that. I'd rather do it in a qualitative way.
Mm-hmm.
Because 1%, if it's the most key defining feature.
Well, that's true.
So if we created this, created a list of alterations that could be considered minor, if we forget something that doesn't make it onto the list, does that create problems down the line if someone...
Of course it does.
Okay.
That's why we have to think of every possible scenario now. That's why this is so easy to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why the city hadn't done it that long time ago, really.
Well, and if I might, this in ways, this is obviously a fast-track process. This is an exceptional timeline. 8 months to turn a legislative process is exceptional. And I don't even do planning. And I know from Jay how hard that is to meet those timelines and meet with all the stakeholders. One thing I would offer is we will have an opportunity to revisit larger policies and historic review as a part of the comprehensive plan. And not to jump to the back page, but I want to make sure you're aware, probably as important as what we're talking about today is what we're not talking about, and that's the out-of-scope work. So relative to the list, Jessica, I think we can do a really good job in getting a lot on the list that's going to do a lot of work for us and make preservation easier to attain. And may potentially have the opportunity to revisit, tweak, if you will, a couple years down the road.
I preferred C of the choices.
To create the list.
Yeah.
And do we want to, as part of our comments, are you looking for us to help draft that list, or is...
We haven't gotten to that point yet.
Okay.
But
when we get to that point, we'll...
Start your list, and then we'll bring it to the table.
I can think of about 20 things.
So just to put more into context, one standard we have that triggers a type 1, though it's not applied to small residential, single-family residential, but to commercial structures, is a type 1 review now, is areas of work less than 500 square feet in area. So it typically applies to storefront remodels, smaller scale storefront remodels, arguably. Maybe there's a number, and I know you just mentioned not quantitative but more qualitative. You know, maybe there's a 200 square foot type one. If you're not altering that much area on a single elevation, from a zoning code standpoint, from a very easy way to explain to someone that might do one land use review in their entire home ownership life, that that's our trigger, that could be part of that list.
Okay.
Then I would just add to tie it to the visibility from the right-of-way, even though I avoid trying to stay visible from the right-of-way, but it, can you have that minor alteration, say it's a, you know, 500 square feet or a percentage, you say, well, if it's on the rear of the house, then it has a lower level of review. So incenting that new, that change to happen in the back.
Okay.
So how do we treat minor alterations if we make this list of them?
Yeah, that's part two. And they have to decide, do you exempt them?
Are they type one or exempt?
Can you have two lists? The exempt, the fully exempt list, and then the...
I think there could be, I dare say it, three lists. There could be one exempt, but you need to meet A, B, and C. There could be one that's a historic confirmation letter, if you will, like a certificate of appropriateness. And then there could be the new and improved type one, if we can legally write it. That's faster, quicker, but needs public comment.
Just to step back for a second on the big picture, when you guys did the research on the other cities and what they do, do they have this level of complexity in their code? It seems like, I was kind of imagining this to be a streamlined process, but I understand where we're going on that, reading it more. It's obviously actually adding a lot more to the code. It's bulking up, it's got more complexity, which then also leaves room for potential misses, you know, too. And I kind of wonder about
that. That's why this is so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be the hardest thing we've ever done, because we got to do it for every district, we got to do it for every situation, we got to do it, and we will. We theoretically could have two new processes that we'd never have before.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough one. Sometimes more is more. In doing the research that we've done here, sometimes less gets you less, and that's the case with the Stark review. Kurt just mentioned it. It's. We've had the same question asked, and we're getting different answers based on the house, based on where it is, based on its orientation to the street, based on its typology. It's very challenging.
Well, that's why I think that when we have an example of something in these four different review classes, I think it will trigger for us things that we're missing, or, you know, how this is going to play out.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the fallback is, if it's not specifically mentioned as an exemption, then it just goes to the regular review like it does right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Other comments about minor alterations? Last category, alterations not visible from the right-of-way.
Oh, we heard quite a bit of discussion about this at the last hearing.
We did.
So I think we've talked about it some. I think that we've all agreed there's potentially a lower bar in the rear, but not necessarily exemption, you know, so.
I think it's a priority.
Yeah.
Isn't that how we kind of looked at it before?
I think we're trying to balance maintaining the integrity of the district for those that are in the district. For instance, not adding, say, a glass vertical box that you can't see from the street because all your neighbors can see it, and it's not consistent with the neighborhood, say, you know. So, but however, maybe there's a little bit more of a rambling addition with like materials that works okay and functionally meets some needs. Is it visually offensive? So how do you codify that? I don't know.
That's why Jay makes the big money.
I'll take a stab at that. The last appeal hearing we had was very helpful for staff in terms of direction from the commission on how to review rear additions. yet again, the dilemma is how to make preservation affordable, fast, quick, but also focus staff's efforts on where it matters. And I think we can agree that there is a priority relative to those facades and their visibility from the street, at least in the context of a historic district, and not a landmark structure. And so with that clarification, one possibility in helping staff focus their efforts where they should arguably focus more acutely, and also incentivizing expansions and additions where we would prefer them to occur, which is at the rear, is coming up with some sort of standards, I dare say, with those in the room, that are exempt from historic review. If we could craft something that says something like matching materials, matching window profiles, matching roof pitches, so on and so forth, potentially with some setback sightline triggers, meaning less visible setback from original exterior mm-hmm. walls, that there's an opportunity there to incentivize by virtue of no land use review fee, but a series of standards that are a checkbox that have to be met in order to achieve either a lower level review, the new type one, or historic confirmation letter, mm-hmm. or just outright exempt. Mm-hmm. The latter probably being the least favorable.
But again, you could have a two-tier thing. Even if it's 100 square feet or less, it's exempt. Or if it's bigger than that, then it's type one if it mm-hmm. meets these criteria. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's possible. We just need to see what the rules would be, I guess. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but...
So as far as formalizing comments, do we want to...
Do you need something formal from us, or do you have enough that when asked tomorrow, you will say...
We can say what feedback we got. If you have additional, I would say definitely pass them along. But I don't think you need to formalize what you've said today.
Okay.
And do we need to discuss Appendix A issues or just know about them? Tim?
It's up to you. I mean, for our part in realizing the time, the deadline we have to get this before council, one thing I've learned in working with BPS and Jay on this is, as I mentioned, this list is often as important as what we're really getting done. And in the course internally, as we talked about this among staff and now I've put it out there, these are all very important issues that are tied to everything we do in historic preservation, but have a complexity in a controversy perhaps that won't allow them to fit within this timeline. But I think it's notable that you review them and think about them, because I think we'll be coming back to them later.
So if we're not formalizing any comments now, or you're just taking what you've heard, so that when you come back the first week of December with that discussion draft, we'll be able to provide more input at that point?
Yes. We'll give you three weeks before the hearing. We'll release the discussion draft, we'll publish it.
Okay.
And so any comments up until probably a week after mm-hmm. the hearing, we'll have a couple weeks to turn it around, incorporate comments into our actual formal proposed draft. Mm-hmm. That will go to Planning and Sustainability Commission.
Okay. And when it comes to brainstorming, like for the minor alterations, brainstorming things that should either be fully exempt or should, you know, only be under the minor review, does that happen at that time? Does that happen before then? Mm. Is that more of an exercise with staff?
Yeah, I would say that's probably more of an internal exercise, but if you'd like to participate, you're more than welcome.
I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to give feedback on those.
Yeah, it's fully appropriate as item is of interest if the commission wants to bat that list around and get it tidy, because as you can imagine, it might get nebulous.
Right.
It may have three columns, and that would obviously help in inserting them into formal comments, because that one might be a little detailed, very importantly detailed,
mm-hmm.
and may take more than 3 weeks to get done. And obviously, it's something you could chew on right now.
Right.
You know, not necessarily.
Why don't I put it on the items of interest for discussion, okay. either at the next meeting or the meeting after that?
Okay. Yeah. And I guess in all of my spare time, I will
start a list.
Start a list, and we can pass it around.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks, Jessica. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Three National Register nominees.